and roll.
Number one for breaking news for Vernon, Farmington, and South Windsor, the Talk of Connecticut, AM 1360 and FM 103.3.
Oh, you know, the Marxist takeover of higher education, oh my goodness, just in the last week, or week and a half even, it's reached a, like a fever pitch. For decades, U.S. universities, especially selective ones, have favored applicants who, you know what I'm saying, like they struck the right social justice notes, right? And they hired faculty that reinforced those views. Then they cemented this zeitgeist with jargon of identity and the oppressor paradigm. But I'm curious how we got here. Good morning. It's Gary Byron. It's 7-Eleven here on this Friday Eve. Our first guest into the Daily Connerton Memorial Company interview chair is the author of the book Next Gen Marxism and the Angels T. Arondo Senior Fellow on E Pluribus. You know, wow, this is a lot of... this is a lot of jargon here. This is a lot of language here at the Heritage Foundation. Let's just keep it that way. Let's keep it simple. Oh, my goodness. I got to find out who this Arendo guy is. His name is Angelus? Is that what his name is?
This is Mike Gonzalez
that we're talking about. No.
Oh,
the Angelus Arendo.
Yes.
Senior fellow on E Pluribus Unum at the Heritage Foundation. Wow. Say that 10 times fast.
I could not.
All right. I can't even say it one time slow. He spent close to 20 years as a journalist, 15 of them writing from Europe, Asia, and Latin America. Let's welcome back to the show, Mike Gonzalez. Mike, good morning.
Hey, Gary. Hello to you and to your listeners in Connecticut. I'll be traveling to the area next week.
Oh, really?
For my son's non-graduation from Columbia University. The name is Angelus T. Arredondo, and she was the mother of a resident of Greenwich who endowed my chair. So that's that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that this, what we're seeing today in our colleges and universities, Columbia, first of all, I'm sorry to say, started at Columbia, is the result of years. This has been years in the making, and we had Katie, my co-author, and I, Catherine Cornell Gorka, we put it on all in our book, Next Gen Marxism. Little did we know when we sat down in late 2022 to write this book that it would come out at such a fortuitous time, fortuitous for the book's sales, not for the country, in that we would be proven so right. Marxism is rampant.
Well, okay, so you say it's been in the making for a long time. Really? So I'll just ask you a simple question. So in other words, 10 years ago, you could have predicted that this time was coming?
You know, first of all, it was predicted in the late 80s when it began, right? But there were many good books written about this. Alan Bloom at Yale wrote The Closing of the American Mind about what was happening at Yale. Roger Kimball wrote a book. Peter, and this is Alan Bloom's book was 1987. Peter Thiel wrote a good book in 1994 about what was happening at Stanford, about how it was going, how identity politics was taken over. So we took our eye off the ball. To answer your question directly, I think that after the fall of the wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, we all thought that Marxism had been defeated, and we took a victory lap, not very smart. And then during 9/11, a lot of us, you know, 9/11 concentrated the mind in the sense that we all thought we had to fight the Islamofascists, and we took our eye off the ball as to the cultural Marxists that were taking over the universities.
Okay, so if the signs were there, as you say, going back to the late 80s, why or how did we take our eye off the ball, as you say?
Yeah, so one more sign, by the way, that we put in our book. In fact, we start our book with it, is an article written in 1989 by the New York Times, of all things, by Felicity Barringer, who had been the Moscow bureau chief. And she writes this article, which we quote at length, and you can find online, where she says, wow, you know, communism is ending in Eastern Europe, but it's really flourishing here in America. And the article is very insightful because she says, but it's not taking over the faculties of economics, where, you know, Marxism was supposed to be about economics. It's taking over the humanities, and it's taking over the law faculties. It's taking over the areas where culture is expressed and analyzed. And that is exactly why it's called cultural Marxism. And then to that, you add the elements of race and sex and climate and all that. These are the new fronts on the war. And now Gaza, this is just a front on the war. We can go into that later.
Yeah, but Mike, I want to go back to the question I just asked you. I mean, if there were telltale signs, why did we take our eye off the ball? Why? I mean, if this was preventative and we didn't need to be where we are today, why didn't we take the necessary steps and measures to prevent the inevitable, to prevent this, what's going on right now?
No, look, I don't want to shirk your answer, and it really is some conservatives that we took our eyes off the ball. And the reasons I gave them to you earlier is the feeling that communism had been defeated, A, but I think most importantly, Katie and I agree that 9/11 made us concentrate our minds. All of us, if you think what I was doing, I was with the Wall Street Journal then, with the editorial page. Practically everything I did had to do with 9/11. Katie the same way. We were all concentrating on being, as we were attacked, what do we do to prevent another attack? What do we do to fight back against our enemies overseas? And we took our eye off the ball about the people who really want to dismantle American culture and American history. I'm afraid, Gary, that's the best explanation I can give you.
There's speculation that the CIA was aware of an attack prior to it happening on September 11th. I don't want to go down the whole conspiracy theory road, but I'm just going to ask you if you have any evidence in your research that the CIA was tipped off prior to September 11th that something was coming.
No, I mean, yes and no, right? But not in a conspiratorial sense. We all knew, you know, the World Trade Center. I worked across the street from the World Trade Center, the Wall Street Journal.
Right, right.
The World Trade Center had been attacked, you know, before. It had been the object of attack by bin Laden. We knew that bin Laden existed. We knew Al-Qaeda existed. We knew there was a threat. I think it would be far-fetched to say that we knew that there was going to be planes hijacked and run into planes in New York and Washington. I don't think that, I mean, I've never seen any evidence of that, nor have I. I'm not a researcher in that area, but I would doubt that would be the case.
All right, let's go back to the universities right now. Why Columbia? Why the Ivy League schools? Why Yale, Harvard, USC, Columbia, NYU? Why there?
Why did Al Qaeda attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Because they were symbols of American power. Why have the Marxists taken over the Ivies first and foremost? Because they're symbols of American power. And by the way, let me say parenthetically that this is one of the reasons why we conservatives cannot abandon the Ivies. We have to fight for them. We have to fight for Chicago and Stanford as well. You know, this is not, they don't belong to the woke. They don't belong to the left. They belong to America.
Okay, but why fight for them when they're teaching and indoctrinating, if you will, the complete opposite of what conservatives stand for?
Oh, completely. Well, not completely. We have to. Look, every time I get to speak to anyone in a position of power, to a politician, we said the message is we have to defund the Ivies. We have to
think of cutting out
the research grants. You know, Harvard makes $500 million a year in federal, in taxpayer money. You know, we have to be serious And I got to tell you, that's going to be an uphill struggle on the Hill, because Republicans, forget Democrats, but Republicans don't want to do it either, because they don't want to defund their alma mater. But we have to be serious about that. We have to demand, make many demands, but it's taken since the 80s to wokeify the universities. They're now thoroughly woke. They if you look at the faculties of many of our top schools, it's 100% liberal or very liberal, and no conservatives whatsoever on the faculty. The things they teach, the way the Columbia core curriculum has been completely changed for the 20th century. No longer is the Cold War the main issue of the 20th century. Now it's decolonization.
Are they learning their lesson? I mean, we say that they need to change their policy and be less woke. We see what's going on in their campuses. So what can they take from this? What have they learned anything? Are they going to become less woke, tomorrow, next week, next month? Or will they continue along their woke, path that they're on right now?
Okay, so there have been some rays of hope. I'm not going to name you three. The dismissal of Liz McGill and Claudine Gay from University of Pennsylvania and Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I think even more important than that, the fact that MIT just this week said it would no longer be demanding
right.
that professors sign a DEI pledge.
Right, right.
That is a big step. We need more, much, much, much more than that. But that is a sign that our message is getting through somehow.
All right, and let's go. How about the protesters? They're still out there protesting. More than half of them. I'd say about two-thirds of them aren't even students of these universities. But yet, they're the one it's the students, particularly the innocent students, who are feeling the brunt of it. You know, they've already said, some of these universities have already said, well, we're not going to have graduation, you know. And if you're just a rank-and-file student at one of these Ivy League schools who's not partaking in these protests, well, you're going to suffer then. The consequences.
Gary, I told you before at the beginning of the interview, my son is at Columbia.
Right.
I talk to him every day. He is mad as hell. He's not going to have a graduation. You know, this is his fourth year. This is outrageous. And by the way.
And he probably didn't have a graduation from high school because of the COVID shutdowns and lockdowns.
That's right. He was cheated. He'd been cheated twice.
Yeah.
He was born right after 9/11. This is the generation that was born in 9/11. Was cheated out of a high school graduation, and now not going to have a college graduation, or the college graduations are going to be marred by protests. By the way, everything that's coming out in political, in tablet, in the Wall Street Journal, demonstrates that these students, the small minority that did protest, were trained by terrorists who were Marxists, and this is all coming out. I mean, these are real Marxists. I'm very happy that we wrote this book, and then we put Marxism on the cover.
Because it's
coming out.
Mike, hold on.
Plunders.
Right there, hold on. Yeah. I got to take a break here. The name of the book is Marxist Takeover of Higher Education. We're talking to Mike Gonzalez. More with him right after this.
Now that spring has sprung, it's time to get your new grill or air conditioner. Ferrari's Appliance has all the name brands at the price you can afford. And they install and service everything they sell. Enough with the pushy salespeople and impersonal customer service. Head to Ferrari's Appliance in Newington or Naugatuck and discover why people from all over choose them over everyone else. Online at Ferrari'sAppliance.com.
If you're like me, you appreciate delicious food at reasonable prices. Hey, it's Gary Byron, and every Friday I head out to dinner at some of Connecticut's most delicious restaurants, from Abigail's Grill and Wine Bar in Simsbury to the fun atmosphere at Market Grill in Manchester, the Republic Gastro Pub in Bloomfield, and the romantic atmosphere of Mill on the River in South Windsor, quickly becoming one of my favorites. Any of these unforgettable locations is going to be perfect for any dining experience. Check them out online at millrestaurantgroup.com. And let's all meet up.
A smarter way to start the day. Gary Byron and the Talk of Connecticut. Listen without a subscription on the Talk of Connecticut free listening app.
All right, 24 minutes after the hour of 7, our guest is the co-author of the book, Next Gen Marxism. Mike Gonzalez. With all the protests and protesters, and they're disrupting college campuses across the country, are the school's Marxist chickens coming home to roost? I mean, what does Columbia or Harvard or NYU or Yale or even MIT, as you mentioned, or Princeton, and many of these other universities that are now being rocked by pro-Palestinian protests, what do they expect? What are they expecting here?
Well, yeah, they should have expected this. The professors themselves are defending the student protesters. They're abandoning the vast majority of the students who just want to study. They want to graduate. Mm-hmm. They want to get jobs. So the professors say they're siding with the students. They're not siding with the students. They're siding with a small sliver who protest, and they're siding with outside agitators, right, and they're siding with the terrorists who train these students. And let me underline that. At Columbia, they held a Zoom training session in March with terrorists from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, from American Muslims, what is the name of the group? American Muslims for Palestine, with terrorists or terrorist sympathizing groups. Lisa Sissian, who is a Marxist agitator who was in Seattle in 1999, who was in Ferguson in 2014, she was at Columbia training the students. This is the administrators have to draw the lessons here.
Mike, along those lines, what's the end game here? Do you see these protests continuing on these college campuses even after school's out and we start heading into the summer months?
Listen, we had months of mayhem in 2020 with BLM. These are the same people.
Yeah.
These are the same networks.
Yeah.
Lisa Fitzian was there. Bill Ayers was
That's
there.
Right.
These are the same trainers, the same, they're going to use the same accounts to get after their people. Unless, and I don't predict this because the FBI and the Justice Department don't want to investigate this, because if they did, they would find out that the people funding this are Democratic Party and Joe Biden donors who are funding this. So they're not going to investigate. But unless our law enforcement gets serious about this, we're going to have, again, 4 years later, summers of mayhem.
Yeah. What should the consequences be?
The consequences should be that these people should be arrested, that the students who participated should be expelled, some of them should be put on no-fly zones, and that the country should – by the way, the country is waking up to this. America hates all this. I travel the country. I'm going to Charleston today. I'll be in New York next week. I was in Texas and California 2 weeks ago. The people I talk to hate what's going on. So I think the people are waking up. The consequences should be – the consequences will have to be felt by a vast change in the climate of opinion.
Well, how long will that take?
Once these things get started, they don't take that long.
Really?
Yeah. No.
Mike, the election's not till November. I just see this moving. I don't see it continuing on college campuses because in another week they're going to be irrelevant. But I don't think they're going away. I think they're just going to move to national monuments.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And desecrate them. They're already vandalizing World War II statues and historic monuments that's been part of our culture, since the founding of our country. I think they're just going to relocate.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you on that, but that's only going to upset more everyday Americans.
So are you saying everyday Americans are going to have to take up with these... individually? I mean, or do you think the law and order will prevail here?
I don't mean that everyday Americans are going to have to take the law into their own hands.
Okay.
I don't mean that.
All right.
I meant that once the country shifts in the way it thinks, it does that, I think.
Well, I don't know what we're waiting for. I mean, I think we've had enough. It's enough. You don't like our way of life? What are you doing here? If I don't like Thai food, I don't go to a Thai restaurant. Simple as that. If you don't like our way of life, what are you doing here? Doesn't make sense. All right. The name of the book is Marx's Takeover of Higher Education. Its author.
No. Oh. Next Gen Marxism.
Next Gen Marxism. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Well, you can buy the book anywhere, right? Amazon? Barnes & Noble?
Right after the show, go to Amazon and buy Next Gen Marxism.
I'm Gianna.
Thanks, Mike.
A Boeing 737 plane carrying
85 Litchfield, people. WDRC, 100 years.
All right, a little breaking news. You ready? Your wallets are now safe. Well, that's because the state legislature has adjourned as of midnight. Technically, that's earlier this morning. A little over 8 hours ago. Sine die. So therefore, for the time being anyways, this is not forever. They can't do any more damage. Good morning. It's Gary Byron. It's 8:11 here on this Friday Eve. Glad to have you on board the old morning train. Joining us into the Daily Connerton Memorial Company interview chair is undoubtedly a very groggy Senate Republican leader who has done a truly fantastic job fighting for all of us, not just his own constituents. But as you know, when you're a leader, you've got to have every constituent throughout the entire state in mind. Let's welcome back State Senator and Senate Republican Leader Stephen Harding. Senator, good morning. Well, did he hang up?
You know how great this phone system is?
Oh, I just got a text from him. Just got kicked off the call, trying to call back, but the line is busy. There he is right there. There he is. Steve.
Hey, sorry about that. I hit the end button by accident.
Oh, that was... we were ready to take the blame for
that. Yeah, I was ready to take the hit.
Yeah. Our phone system is known for that. Our phone system is so old, it's known for that. So, yeah.
Next time I'll bring the phone system. Point taken.
Next time we got to get you in here. I mean, the fact that you're...
Now the session's over, I'm in. You got it, my man.
All right, brother. I mean, I as it is, I know it was a late night last night, and I feel bad that, you know, you're probably groggy, and the last thing you wanted to do was talk politics at 8 o'clock in the morning. But we all appreciate it.
Gary, if you're on the other line, I'm always wanting to talk. You know that, number one. And number two, with a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old at home, there's no such thing as sleep. So I got a number of years that sleep comes against them.
I appreciate that, Steve. That really does mean a lot to me. So listen, congrats on the end of the session and for successfully leading the fight to block some absolutely horrendous Democrat proposals. Talk about that. Talk about the bad bill. We're going to talk about everything this morning, the good, the bad, the ugly. Let's start with the bad bills that you helped, I guess, defray.
Yeah, well, I would say that the House Republicans certainly joined us in that effort, but I am so proud to be part of the caucuses, the 12 Senate Republican caucus members. You know, we came in every day with a mission to kill some really bad bills that would have been extremely detrimental to our neighbors and our districts and people of the state as a whole. And I think we were very successful in that mission. I think there were a lot of bills that really could have been terrible policy. Now, we've talked about it over the weeks as we've led into the end of session with you. some really bad policies that were on the table that were taken off the table because of the fact that the Senate Republicans and joining the House Republicans to fight back these measures and to talk as long as it took to fend these off. I mean, these are measures such as, you know, again, stripping away more local zoning control, more efforts to implement statewide zoning efforts, the green monster, which would have potentially put a gas tax or TCI on your fuel every time you filled up, different measures that were just fiscally irresponsible beyond words. You also had some really bad, you know, criminal justice measures, which would have prevented police officers from pulling individuals over for secondary stops and potentially investigating other worse crimes, making the crime problem we have in the state even worse. I mean, so these were all measures that were left on the table, fortunately, with Democrats unable to push them forward despite a strong effort on their part to make it possible. And I couldn't be prouder to be part of an incredible caucus that were, you know, that did this last night.
You know, I'm listening to you, and you're right. I mean, it's really your team of Republican senators and Vinny's team of Republican House members that really showed strength in stretching out these debates. You know, I talk about it from time to time here on the show of what it's like to talk up a bill, to filibuster so that you're really ticking away at the clock, right? I mean, especially last night when you go see an ADA, there's no go list tomorrow. It whatever doesn't get through, you know, yesterday, that's it. It's dead.
Correct.
Dies on the vine, as I like to say. But if you can, because even though I've talked about it on a number of occasions, I want to get a different person's perspective. Talk about the skill of, well, just being able to talk and talk. Yep. And talk and talk.
Well, you're on the phone with an Irish Catholic politician, so I'm one person that's not afraid to talk. But we're fortunate to have a lot of members that understand the art of, you know, essentially filibustering. And there was a number of articles that came out that cover, you know, the state government and the Capitol about how you really had a rejuvenated effort in the Senate Republican caucus this year and the House Republican caucus for that measure as well. The filibuster is a really bad dose. And you know, being in the minority in Hartford and fighting the good fight with us for the number of years you were up there, you know, when you're in the minority, that's your biggest leverage point.
It is
filibustering and bringing the clock to midnight when no other bills can be brought out afterwards. So, you know, we were very successful in, you know, negotiating some good bills, some positive efforts, but more importantly, as I said, killing some really bad bills. And it was used by just simply getting up, talking, talking on the bill, which you're required to do, finding questions, pointing out the errors in the bills that were before us. And I think, you know, this year I couldn't be prouder of all my Senate Republicans who really stepped up to the plate, spoke on all the bills, you know, even in late into the night, understanding that by doing so, they were making our negotiation, our leverage that much stronger as Republicans to fight off some really terrible measures that were on the table.
All right, Steve, let's play a game. Let's do a lightning round. We hear all the time that listeners like this. Here's a lightning round. All right. So did any meaningful election integrity reform get passed to address the Wanda Jeters of the world?
No. And if it's a yes or no, the answer is simply no. They passed a measure very late. That was a really weak measure that did nothing other than put cameras or require some cameras on some of these drop boxes and pretended that was going to resolve the problem. Senator Sampson put a resilient effort in, putting all of the Senate Republican efforts on a bill and put the Democrats on record against voting against all those common sense measures, which would have actually voted, which would have restored a lot of voter integrity and confidence.
That's too bad. How about any meaningful bills passed to lower energy costs?
In fact, you could argue that there were some measures that were passed by Democrats that increased energy costs. And in fact, one of the biggest bills that would have raised energy costs exponentially, $5,004, fortunately, was fought off by Republicans. But the Democrats were pushing that bill right to the very end, to the last moment. And you're talking about a bill that would have driven up energy costs to the levels we couldn't even imagine.
Okay. And I think we kind of know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask you anyways. Did the electric vehicle, the EV mandate study bill, pass?
It did not. And that was another thing that we were very happy that we saw did not go forward. As we've talked about, it was nothing more than an EV mandate. They wanted an excuse to compose a study group again after the election to tell the folks in the state of Connecticut we have a plan to implement an EV mandate after November of this year, and we were very happy that we could fight that off at the end.
Blood alcohol level with did that get passed?
It did not. No, that did not move forward either.
How about that crazy?
Again, I think it's just the irony is incredible that, you know, basically you can have marijuana in your car. You could smoke marijuana. A police officer can't pull you over, even if they observe you smoking marijuana.
While driving. Yeah, go figure that.
Yeah. We want to reduce the BAC level.
Did that crazy green monster climate crisis bill pass? I mean, that's the bill that would have given What, the unelected deep commissioner, vast powers to pass taxes and new government programs, right?
Yes, that was 5004 that I was referencing before.
Oh,
that
okay.
was one of the bad bills that I said we were right off, fortunately. So, no, that did not pass. The Green Monster bill did not move forward. The House Bill 5004. And, again, I out of all the bills that I've seen in that chamber, that arguably could be one of the scariest bills, you know, that I've seen, just because it was a bill that we didn't even know the magnitude of what it could do. Because basically we were ceding our authority to an unelected bureaucrat to implement measures that could cost, you know, taxpayers of the state amounts of money that we could only imagine, which is a scary thought.
All right, and then I'll do one more. This is more, I guess, for confirmation. The Democrats passed that job-killing paid sick leave mandate, right?
Well, so, yeah they did. That was unfortunate to see. That was one of the bills that we fought against, and Senate Republicans resoundingly voted against unanimously. But unfortunately, they did get that in before the midnight deadline. It's gonna phase down to employers that have as little as just simply one employee to be forced to provide paid sick leave. And I understand that the cause is noble, but I mean, this is something that, you know, you talk about a growing business that would consider hiring an employee now. They're going to say, no, I'm not going to do that. It's strictly a job killing bill. That's really what the bill is. It's simply a job killing bill.
Boy, look, the Republican campaign, it really starts today, right? And
absolutely.
Your team needs to get reelected and hopefully add some seats. And there's plenty of issues to run on, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we just went over a plethora of issues. If Republicans don't gain in the Senate and they don't gain in the House, the proposals that we just talked about killing will inevitably come back, and if we don't gain our margins, we'll succeed in passing, which is scary for the fiscal health and the direction of this state. So it is just critically important, starting today and every day here until November 5th, that we work to get Republican senators elected across the state.
All right, this is what we're going to do, because I'm going to totally switch gears. So I might as well just take that. I have another minute or so, but I'm going to take the break right now. When we come back, I'm going to ask you, so we talked about the bad, we talked about the ugly. We're going to talk about the good, if there's any good that passed. And I'm also going to ask you, what's in the pipeline for next year? More with Senate Republican leader Steve Harding right after this.
Yankee Peddler and Pawn in East Hartford is Connecticut's premier pawn shop, paying you top dollar whether you are pawning or selling your items. It's also your first choice to find great deals on used items. Yankee Peddler and Pawn has everything from gold and silver jewelry to electronics, power tools, some musical instruments, and so much more. With nearly 200 five-star Google reviews, customer service is always their number one priority. Go see Joe at Yankee Peddler and Pawn at 7 Pitkin Street in East Hartford and tell them Gary sent you.
Hi, can I help you?
Hi, yeah, I'm looking for a doodad that fits this thingamajiggy.
We just got in a new shipment of doodads.
Great. Oh, and I also need a what's it? You got those?
Sure do. Keeping them right next to the doohickey. Follow me.
Lakeland Lumber Company, 747 South Main Street, Torrington. Lumber delivery, decking, Anderson Windows, kitchens, baths, and thingamabobs. Iflin, your full-service hardware store. Iflin Lumber, Torrington.
Number one for breaking news for Vernon, Farmington, and South Windsor. The Talk of Connecticut. AM 1360 and FM 103.3.
23 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock. Our guest is Senate Republican leader Steve Harding, who joins us every other Thursday. It's also the day after the final day of the 2024 legislative session. All right, so we talked about the bad. We talked about the ugly. Let's talk about the good. Was there any good that got passed? Any Republican bills get passed?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of measures. You know, I think ultimately, you know, our main mission, you know, being in the minority, is looking to fend off the bad measures that are being proposed by the majority in Hartford, the Democrats in Hartford. And so, you know, obviously, you know, what is passed is usually not as strong and vibrant as what we have, the bad that we have fought off. But,
right.
You know, there are some small measures that were taken that my Senate Republican colleagues were very strong in advocating for and working hard for their districts. There were some measures that would, you know, protect, you know, law enforcement with some FOI requirements and, protect them from, basically being harassed for simply just doing their job and protecting our community members in a reasonable and responsible manner. And also other measures to support our law enforcement related to, corrections officers and seeking, mental health treatment. And there were also measures that, help clarify some of the 8-30G laws, which are really onerous for small communities and are such a burden in forcing certain development that is, antithetical to local zoning laws. So Representative O'Day passed a bill that brought upstairs in collaboration with a lot of our Senate Republican colleagues that would have clarified some 8-30G language and would have helped with those calculations. Which does help indirectly with local zoning control. So there were definitely some measures that were somewhat positive, and other measures as well. But again, I think usually being in the minority, as you know, Gary, the focus usually is fighting off some really bad stuff.
Yeah. All right. So let's kind of. This is kind of fun as well. I mean, we know you don't have a crystal ball. I mean, we don't expect anything, to hear anything definitive. But look, you're in a leadership position. You're in a very powerful position as the Senate Republican leader. Let's play another game and let's open up our crystal ball here. And I want to state again, I can't emphasize enough, this is not definitive. This is just hypothetical. What do you see in the pipeline for next year? Because remember now, the election will be in everybody's rearview mirror. Right. You'll have a new legislature, and it'll be the long session, right? So what do you see in the pipeline for the 2025 legislative session?
Well, I mean, I think that's why it's critically important to frame who we elect. Because if you continue to elect the strong majorities of Democrats in Hartford, you're going to see the fiscal guardrails that have kept our state afloat fiscally completely eroded. And the Democrats, the leadership in the Democratic Party in Hartford has been very open to the fact that if they have a strong majority going into Hartford in 2025, that they are going to rip apart and modify those guardrails significantly to the point where we're going to once again as a state be fiscally irresponsible and put us back to the ways of a generation ago that set us back fiscally for a generation. That's how critically important this next election is for our state. I think that if you elect Republicans, you're going to see those fiscal guardrails maintained. You're going to see a government in which the taxpayer money is going to be valued. It is going to be spent and invested responsibly. There's going to be a focus on putting that money back in the wallets and the pocketbooks of the hardworking people of the state, as opposed to continuing to funnel our bureaucracy in Hartford. That's really what it comes down to this next election. It really is so critically important. I can't overestimate how important and oversell how important this election is fiscally for the health of our state. You're also going to, you'll see policies that will support our law enforcement, which will strengthen our ability to protect our communities, which we're seeing, violence in our communities tick up. Unfortunately, if you elect Republicans and a stronger majority or at least a stronger minority, hopefully a majority, you're going to see efforts to protect our communities. Particularly bolster our law enforcement, allow them to protect themselves and our community. If you elect Democrats, the majority that they currently have now, they will continue to erode their abilities to protect themselves and protect our communities. It's that simple. These are very basic measures that as you move into the next session, this is what is at stake as we move into the November.
But let's get specific. This EV mandate, I tell people, okay, yeah. So it's not dead. It's just, look, the end of session, it's sleeping. It'll be back. How, in what form do you think it will be back next year?
Again, and this goes back. If you elect the Democrats, the majority they have in Hartford, there will be an EV mandate at the end of next session. Mark my words. If you elect Democrats to Hartford and they have the majority that they continue to have now, they will once again revisit the EV mandate. And in the beginning of next session, they will push to pass it. If you elect more Republicans, there will be much more of a force against it, and there will be a chance that we can fight that back and fight off this EV mandate, which is such impractical, illogical policy. We've discussed it time and time again. But, you know, frankly, if you see the majorities that Democrats have now, if they continue to have those majorities, unfortunately, I have very little reason to doubt they will push every single effort.
There you have it, folks. Hey, Steve, you know, you've really invigorated your caucus. It's your first session as Senate Republican leader. Look, and it's really a testament to your leadership. And I know later this spring or maybe in the summer, we're going to have to. I really want to have you in the studio live for a full hour, maybe even taking some questions.
I would love that.
And I really value your time with us every other Thursday. And by the way, not to let you off talk, this continues during the off session, you know. So
I'm looking forward to it.
All right, brother.
Even more fun.
I'll be in touch with you. All right, buddy. Thanks for your time. All right, when we come back, it's open phones. I would say call right now. Get in the queue. And that way, we'll get you on. Stay with us.
Fox News, I'm CJ Papas.
103.3.
Look, I mean, so much going on everywhere. Right? In your town, in the state of Connecticut, in our nation, in the world for that matter, right? But the thing you got to keep in mind today, especially from the perspective of state government, from our legislature, is that the 2024 legislative session is, for all intents and purposes, over. And we were discussing this last hour. It ended last night by going CNADA at midnight. Well, technically, I guess that's this morning. And the next legislative session does not occur until January. So in other words, it's after the next election for our state legislators. So we don't know what the makeup will be there quite yet. But it does, we'll begin the first Wednesday after the first Monday in January. And it's the long session, which means a couple of things. Number one, it'll go until the first Wednesday after the first Monday in June. So you're adding the bookends. So it'll be 6 months. And it's the biennium budget year. So now it's, they leave the Capitol or left the Capitol last night and campaign season begins. Good morning. It's Gary Byron, 9/11 here on this Friday Eve, the ninth day of May. Very happy to have you on board the old morning train. Our next guest into the Daily Connerton Memorial Company interview chair is a former colleague of mine in the legislature. We've even shared a couple of committees together. You won't find a more articulate and sharp. This guy knew the bills. He knew the issues and he knew them well. Also, he's a former lieutenant gubernatorial candidate. This is when Bob Stefanowski ran the first time. And he joins us typically every other Thursday, today being one of those days. Let's welcome back to the show former state senator Joe Markley. Joe, good morning.
Good morning to you, Gary. Pleasure to be with you.
Always a pleasure. And
it's we didn't have to go through the ringer of these last few days of the session. But I'm glad on behalf of those who do that it's behind them, because it's a pretty stressful time.
Okay.
And I might go so far as to say a pretty disgraceful time. I think what people need to realize about the way the legislature works is that because there are full time legislatures where bills can be going on constantly and there's not this sense of a deadline. But in Connecticut, like I believe in most states, there is a beginning and an end to the legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that at midnight, the whatever you've done is done, and whatever you haven't done, you're not going to get to it. So it's like the end of the school year.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a newspaper article saying that the legislature was wrapping up business last night. And I thought, I wish that it were like that it ended with saying, okay, well, we've got a few more things to take care of, and, you know, we're just finishing off the to-do list. What happens is a huge number of bills remain in line, I think because the legislative leaders themselves don't handle these things properly, and there's a tremendous crush as midnight approaches to pass bills frequently without much debate, frequently without really knowing. Sometimes you have the texts are unavailable or only recently available. You don't really have a chance to scrutinize them. And at least my experience in the Senate, it was never good, but sometimes it was pretty awful with the auction, with the clerk of the Senate reading the bill names and numbers like an auctioneer to try to get through everything before midnight. And I found it a particularly discouraging and even a disgraceful way of doing business.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad that we actually have you on this morning and that you're not on the opposite Thursdays, because obviously for the, you know, today being the morning after seeing ADA last evening.
Yes.
And I people hear me talk every morning, and I talk about my, you know, about my tenure in the legislature in my couple of terms there. And I try to articulate the best I can about, you know, how it's stressful, it's maddening, it's chaotic, it's rewarding in some regards, and it's saddening in others. And maybe you, from a different perspective, I mean, I give people the House perspective, and I just had Steve Harding on last hour. So, I mean, he's been in the House with me, and I know he's in the Senate now and the Senate Republican leader, but maybe we can get a perspective from you and on what it's like the 3 days, the Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday leading up to seeing ADA, because there's a lot of horse trading going on. There's it's the bill where they, it's like a consensus bill where they take several bills and they vote, they put them all together. What's the word I'm looking for?
Omnibus bills, or
yeah, well,
there's also. Yeah, and of course the things that get tucked into larger bills that suddenly appear that you were not there before by amendment, and there's a tremendous amount of that going on, because they only have time to get so many bills through, so they try to squeeze as much into those bills as they can.
And I was trying to explain filibustering as well. It's the most powerful tool that Republicans, we in the minority party, really have to try to kill a bill. I mean, because, you know, like a football game where you're up against the clock, you know, that's, we can talk up a bill. I mean, there's more members in the House than there are the Senate, but if we got to talk up a bill, you know, that prevents it from A, from being voted on, but B, it also prevents other bad bills from being called. Maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, it's a different kind of filibuster than what you think of at the national level. It's a matter, because the clock is ticking, the majority party that controls the agenda realizes that they can only afford to have so much time spent on any given bill. So as we get to the end of the session, the Republicans have the opportunity to talk about the bills. And, you know, frequently this conversation is a reasonable conversation. It's that the bills should receive scrutiny on the floor. Questions should be asked, and there should be a sense of vetting to make sure things are ready. So it's a legitimate use of time. Sometimes, of course, the Republicans are doing it to play the clock, and I would say that even though there aren't as many senators as there are House members, John Kissel, as a talker, has the capacity of making up for, I think, any five House members. So the Senate Republicans are pretty good at that. And, you know, my hat's off to Steve Harding. I heard part of your interview with him, but Stephen has used that power. I think he hasn't been afraid to be more combative and more willing to take the Democrats on this. A lot of times I felt like we ran the clock down, and then at the last minute we kind of folded and said, okay, well, we'll vote on a whole bunch of bills at once. And I feel like if your goal is to prevent bills from passing, why make a deal? Just go ahead and hold to your premise. So that's how last night goes, in part. And there is a lot I don't know if you'd call it horse trading exactly, but certain bills that have interested parties, there's negotiations going on, which can be between legislators, between parties, between interests, you know, people that are affected by the bills saying, I can live with this and I can't live with that. And the negotiations, like any negotiation, if you say, well, there's a deadline of midnight, you just tend to run up close to that deadline. But the downside of it is that often the deal isn't made until very late, and then there's very little time to really see what it is you've got. You're kind of doing it on faith. It's a bad way of doing business, and there were legislative sessions that ended, to my mind, in such chaos that, first of all, the people of Connecticut would have been alarmed and ashamed if they saw the way that the legislature was functioning in those last few hours. Mm. And again, I feel like we're not doing our job right if we aren't taking the time to make sure that these laws are written correctly before we pass them. That's something that I talked about a lot in the Senate. I did my best on several occasions to force things to be to force the importance of this issue. And I don't really know why the leadership has allowed to continue that way. I don't think it serves either party well. And I do believe this could all be corrected if people said, we're not going to do it this way anymore. It's not a matter of creating new laws or new rules. It's a matter of people saying we have to behave more responsibly. And that could be a bipartisan agreement and a happy agreement for everybody, but it has not happened in my time in the legislature. It's only gotten worse.
When I learned that the EV bill, and let's face it, it was going to be a study, a task force to get together and study it. It wasn't the actual, you know, bill itself. When I learned that that was pretty much dead, the question I was receiving from a lot of people, both on the air and offline, was, well, if this was so important to the Democrats, and that really right out of the gate when the session started in February, I mean, this was like this is the bill everybody was talking about, and they control the House and the Senate, well, and they control what bills get called and which ones don't. Why didn't they call it? The simple answer that I gave to them, and I want to get your input on this. I said they probably didn't want to put a lot of their senators and House members of their caucus on the record in an election year for voting for something in which they knew the general population of the state was kind of against. Even Democrat voters, not all, but many, were against this mandate. And that's the answer that I gave. I said, if this were last year or next year, I think it would be a different case because it's not an election year. But I want to get your opinion on that. Why do you think some bills that get a lot of media attention, they're controversial for one reason or another, the Democrats are hell-bent on it, and then it's never even gets called for a vote?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. There are vulnerable legislators, or legislators who feel they're vulnerable, whether they are or not, who look at bills like that and say, I don't want to be on the record. And that's part of the negotiation frequently, is the Democratic leadership is trying to get as many of their Democratic colleagues comfortable with voting for the bill. And that might involve saying, well, we'll change this or we'll change that, and can you live with this, and so forth. And that, again, that's a kind of a negotiation that drags on and drags on. And because there isn't, the only deadline is the deadline that they hit last night, that kind of negotiation can go on for quite a while. But you're absolutely right. The Democrats have the power to put bills like that through. And if they had done it, if it were ready to go a week ago, there wouldn't have been any time pressure on them. Republicans can hold things up for a certain number of hours, but they can't hold them up for days and days. And so it is kind of a dysfunction within the majority party that they can't move their agenda forward. It also ought to be a sign to them. You know, when you're talking about a bill where you've got your own members saying, this is so unpopular, I can't vote for it, you might ask yourself, well, why are any of us voting for it? If the people of Connecticut don't want it.
That's right. All right, stay right there. I got to take a short break. More with former State Senator Joe Markley right after this.
No one ever likes calling their insurance company. It usually means there's a problem. And when there's a problem, you don't want to talk to a stranger. You want your agent, the agent who knows you. That's Michael Van Otterkirk and his staff at State Farm of Newington. State Farm has been the number one auto insurer in the U.S. every year since 1946. So when a problem arises, you'll be relieved to call State Farm of Newington, 860-666-1037. Because like a good neighbor, State Farm of Newington is there.
Yankee Peddler and Pawn in East Hartford is Connecticut's premier pawn shop, paying you top dollar whether you are pawning or selling your items. It's also your first choice to find great deals on used items. Yankee Peddler and Pawn has everything from gold and silver jewelry to electronics, power tools, some musical instruments, and so much more. With nearly 200 five-star Google reviews, customer service is always their number one priority. Go see Joe at Yankee Peddler and Pawn at 7 Pitkin Street in East Hartford and tell them Gary sent you.
Hungry for the truth? Turn up Gary Byron and Joe the Producer, the talk of Connecticut. AM 1360 Hartford and AM 610 Litchfield.
24 minutes after the hour of 9, our guest is former state senator and lieutenant gubernatorial candidate, Joe Markley. Differentiate between the short legislative session and the long legislative session. And I don't mean... Well, you can include the biennium budget in the longer session, but let the listener understand what the difference between the two sessions are.
Well, the main difference is 5 months in the long session versus 3 months in the short session. So all the problems that you have in the long session are intensified by the short session. The trade-off on that is that the short session is supposed to only involve fiscal issues. The idea is the long session is when all kinds of things are brought up.
But that's not true. And you and I both know that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a kind of a lip service to it, but really it ends up being the same thing. But the crafting of the two-year budget is a particularly big undertaking for the legislature that takes place in the long session. The short session, the theory is we'll just go in and make necessary changes. But I don't know that it was ever really honored, and it certainly isn't particularly honored now. I guess I'd say I don't see any problem. If you're always going to be, it's like a kid that doesn't do his homework on time. It doesn't matter whether you give somebody 2 days or 2 weeks if they're going to wait until the night before it's due. You know, and in that sense, it doesn't bother me that there's a short session because there's time to get the work done if the work were tackled properly, and if the legislature can find itself to the things it really has to do instead of having it be something where they say, oh, you know, here's a good idea. And this is one of the problems with the legislature. It's very congratulatory. When the session ends, the leadership gets up and says, you know, we did the people's business and, you know, the process works and all this kind of stuff. The question isn't how many bills you pass. It's how much good did you actually do for the state of Connecticut? And legislators kind of feel that simply passing bills is doing good. It doesn't mean that the policy is good. And in fact, it's really a very bad way to be judging your work as a legislator simply by saying, how many bills did I pass? But that's what it comes down to too often.
I asked Steve Harding last hour, you know, and this is... This is kind of loose, but there's no crystal ball here, of course, and there's nothing definitive. We're just speculating. What do you think will be in the pipeline for next year's longer session, biennium session, new legislature session? What do you think is on the agenda?
Well, again, the first thing is always the budget, and the budget is going to be a problem next year, as it usually is when the
There's no more ARPA money. There's a fiscal cliff next year.
Yes, exactly. And this is part of this is because of these fiscal guardrails that went in place in 2017 and that put limits on the amount of state spending and the use of surplus money and how much we put in the rainy day fund and all those things. And it does confine the legislators' hands to some extent. The trouble is they spend too much of their effort not figuring out how to get state government effective enough, efficient enough that it can live within its limits, and instead finding ways to try to work around these guardrails. That's why I'd rather have guardrails than not. But you know, if you're driving a big truck down the hill and you hit the guardrails, you can go through it anyway. And at a certain point, you need good drivers more than you need good guardrails.
Yeah, sadly, the people of Avon know that all too well. All right, so because I can't get anything too heavy because we only have a minute. I'll tell you what, I'll give it to you. Something you want to bring up, you got 60 seconds.
Hey, I'll tell you one thing. You mentioned, of course, my candidacy for lieutenant governor back in 2018. I have to say, honestly, Gary, one of the reasons that the office appealed to me is because the lieutenant governor presides over the
Senate. That's right, yeah.
And having spent many years sitting there frustrated with the procedure, I thought, boy, if they put the gavel in my hand, I think I could do something to straighten this out. And the very threat that you had somebody in charge that was not going to put up with nonsense, I think would have been enough to prevent a lot of the nonsense from happening. You know, you'd say, okay, we got to live with Markley now, so we know what he's going to do. So now we've got to get clean up our act a little bit.
Well, it's kind of a good thing to have on your resume. I mean, that's something you have that I don't yet.
Well, it's a failed candidate for anything is a small item on the resume, but it was an interesting process, and I was proud to have been.
And it's an experience not many others have had. Joe Markley, I look forward to 2 weeks. Thanks for your time this morning.
Gary, talk to you then.
You got it, buddy. All right, when we come back, it's open phones. I see one line open. I want that one to be for you, so call right now.
Fox News, I'm Therese Crowley. Stormy Daniels back for a cross-examination by the Trump defense team today in a New York court after Judge Juan Mer-